And perhaps you figured it out, perhaps you didn't, or perhaps you're young and that question is being asked of you, and trying to figure that out is like finding a needle in a haystack for some. Or here's one that might be more relevant for a number of us, is that when you retire, now that's kind of a biblical, unbiblical concept, but you know the idea that when you finish up this thing and continue on with God and do what he's asking you to do, and that continued investment, but when you're done your regular day job, and how God's called you to minister there, what does that look like? And the way you answer that question has probably got a lot to do with, well, I would love to, and how you finish that sentence has a lot to do with, well, this is what would really satisfy and fulfill heart's desires. What about the heart specifically? Is that easy to figure out, you know? Ever thought you found it, then later you didn't? You thought, this works, this is satisfying, and then you get bored with whatever, and, okay. I wonder if there's any connection between all the stuff we've collected over the years, just check out your garage, and our pursuit of happiness, you know? And I have a long history with garages, I won't go into that, but that's another topic, right? But I thought of, when I used this illustration, that, well, I could take this different directions, but I'm just staying on this course here this morning. But, well, as we begin our summer series, as Amanda's introduced us to it, we begin in an unusual spot. We begin with a man, and you'll know who he is, but I'm not going to tell you who he is right away. But we begin with a man who's testing his heart by filling his garage. And perhaps he is the ultimate hoarder. And so I want you to turn with me to that text. And as soon as I tell you the name of the book, many of you, some of you won't know this, but some of you will, turn to Ecclesiastes. And if you don't have a clue where Ecclesiastes is, don't worry about it. Probably the person beside you may not know either. So just go to the index. And if you don't have a Bible, there are blue Bibles in the pew, back of the pew in front of you. Said that a million times. And find the page number, Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And as we come to this text, as we get to where we want to go here this morning, we ask the question, how full is this guy's garage? I mean, this could be a reality television show as we read this morning. And so Ecclesiastes 2, let's just walk through a couple of these, number of these verses here. But notice he says, I said in my heart, this individual, some of you know who he is, some of you don't. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. And so notice here, right up front, he tells us what's going on. He's what's he doing? He said, well, I said in my heart. So there's a clue right there that this is a deep adventure. This is not a one-off kind of like, I thought about it for a minute and then I moved on to another thing. No, heart, it's the deepest part of who you are. This is a very reflective process as is revealed in this book and other books that he wrote. This is a very deep reflective process. I said in my heart, come now and I will test you. Test is the idea of poking at something to see what it's made out of. That's the idea of this word, to see the substance of it, or in the context, to see what? To see what brings satisfaction. Come now and I will test you with pleasure. Pleasure. Pleasure is the treasure. Notice what he tells us before he tells us anything about the test. He kind of tells us right off the top, but behold, this was vanity. So he tells us he's going to do a test. He tells us it's a deep reflection of his heart. He's going to test his heart with pleasure, but he tells us right off the top that it was vanity. It was a worthless endeavor, like the Blue Jays season, right? Kind of a worthless endeavor. Sorry, but... And then notice how he illustrates this worthless endeavor. He says in verse 2, I said of laughter. Now, this is an odd combination of ideas. I said of laughter, it is mad. And of pleasure, what use is it? Now, seriously, how many times have you thought of, well, laughter is madness. And pleasure is useless. Is this guy depressed? Is this what's going on here? This is an odd combination of ideas and of emotion. Laughter, madness. Pleasure, useless. He's saying that he's walked down the path of pleasure and he's lived the laughter chapter. And his conclusion, it's vanity. It's worthless. So we just stop here and pause and we just ask the question, just as we reflect here, is this possible? Is this a possibility? Could somebody actually do this kind of test, deep reflection, and come to these conclusions? Does this ring true with reality? Is this just some ancient story that has no relevance to today? Or is there relevance here? Well, notice how he goes on, another odd combination. He says in verse 3, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. And my heart's still guiding me with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly. What do you notice here? This is, again, an odd combination of words. Pleasure is useless. Laughter is madness. And then he says, well, I'm going to try to indulge my body with wine. And we know there was women involved with this as well, if you know who I'm talking about here. But wine is intoxicating. It captivates. It's addictive, right? Some of us know firsthand the dangers of wine. But then he says, but also I have in my arsenal, I have wisdom. Wisdom is the opposite. Wisdom, I mean, wine captivates. Wisdom liberates. It brings clarity. If you know about wisdom, wisdom helps us live a sensible life, a successful life, a functional life. He says, I have wine and I have wisdom. Really? And then you notice what he says, and how to lay hold on folly, how to embrace foolishness. So if I said to you, I have two bottles on this counter. One bottle is a bottle of wine. Another bottle is a bottle of wisdom. And I said to you, I embraced foolishness. That's how I lived my life. I just headlong into foolishness. And I came back to you and I said, guess what bottle I drank out of? It wouldn't be that hard for you to figure that out, would it? Now, he could have just jumped to verse 10. He doesn't, but look at verse 10 and what he says. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all of my toil. He could have just gone from verse 3 to verse 10 and skipped the middle, but he doesn't. What does he do? Verse 4, 5, 6, he walks us through his garage. And you know how big his garage is? Well, if you know who we're talking about, you think, wow, it's a big garage. It's Solomon, biggest garage ever. Now, I just Googled this, so this could be completely wrong, but I'm just taking a chance here, but I've heard this many, many times. So are these numbers exact? I don't know, but Solomon is considered, when you add up his wealth, to have been the wealthiest man who's ever lived on the planet. They list some of the wealthiest, like Henry Ford, $199 billion. Number four of all time, Andrew Carnegie at $310 billion. Rockefeller at $663.4 billion. King Solomon, if he wasn't one of the wealth, if he wasn't the wealthiest, he was certainly one of the wealthiest. When you add up all his wealth that is recorded in the Old Testament in terms of today's modern, you know, dollar bill, $2.1 trillion worth of wealth. It's fair to say he has a fairly large garage. He has a lot of wine. And so what's in his garage? Well, let's just read this. Verse 4. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. And notice the word here, I made. You'll see this repeated several times. Verse 5. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them and all kinds of fruit trees. Hey, I just planted two pear trees this spring, so there's a little bit of common ground here. I made myself pools from which to water the forests of growing trees. Wow. And then he made stuff, and then he bought stuff. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before in me in Jerusalem. And then so not only did he make stuff and he bought stuff. Now verse 8, I gathered for myself silver, gold, and treasures of kings and provinces. I got singers and both men and women and many concubines, the delight of children of men. And so what does he do? He makes stuff, he buys stuff, and he gathered stuff. And then when he was done, what did he do? He did it again. I make stuff, I buy stuff, I gather stuff. I made stuff, I bought stuff, I gathered stuff. I made stuff, I bought stuff, I gathered stuff. I mean, Solomon equals a modern day hoarder, all right? His garage wouldn't have had room for his chariots, as you can see by the picture. The car is on the outside, right? And then note what he says. In verse 9, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. I won. He not only kept up with the Joneses, you know that saying, he blew the Joneses out of the water, right? Completely blew them out of the water. But notice what he says in verse 9. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Seriously? It did? You know, you can have a treadmill in your basement and never use it. You can have a Bible in your house and never open it. I think you can have wisdom and never employ it, never execute it, never really embrace it fully. We come to his summary statement, whatever my eyes desired, it did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all of my toil. He won. He kept up with the Joneses. More than that, he blew the Joneses away. But does the emotion of this text say that he won? He goes on, verse 11. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. Vanity, worthlessness. Vanity literally means vapor in this context, vapor. And then notice he says right after that word that means vapor, a striving after the wind. It's the imagery of if you were to take your hand and do this, and I say, well, how much wind did you get? How much did you gather in? It's just useless. And he's saying, I did this. I strove after all of this, and I filled up my garage, and I ended up with all his vanity, he says. This didn't end well for Solomon, did it? Some of us know the story. I won't read much of it. But his life did not end well. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and did not wholly follow the Lord as David, his father, had done. Remember, there was Saul, then there was David, and then there was Solomon. Solomon built high places for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Molech, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. And so he did for all his foreign wives who made offerings and sacrifice to their gods. And the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who appeared to him twice. Wine is on the counter. Wisdom is on the counter. What bottle do you think he drank out of the most? How did his life end? Here's how I would conclude the matter. His garage is full, but his heart is empty. Or he has attempted to make good things, ultimate things. Everything he mentions in this text, mostly it's good stuff, most of it. But he made good things, ultimate things. He has lived a life to the full, but come up short. To use his words, laughter is mad. Those are his own words. Pleasure is what? It's useless. I come back to the question, is this possible? Does this ring true with reality? Is this just some ancient story that has no relevance to today? Or could the character of Solomon be found in office towers, bars, church pews, cozy neighborhoods, gyms, vacation resorts today? Well, it's with this story as our backdrop that we now come to our first parable. You're thinking, oh my goodness, he's only getting to the parable now. It's a short parable, and I'm just going to make a few comments. So don't sweat it, even though we have air conditioning. But it's with this backdrop, it's with this human need is with this human passion and desire and this sense of wanting to fill up that we come to the parables. And we come to this one particular parable as we begin our series. It's Matthew 13. It's on the screen behind you. Some of you will see this parable as a cup of cold water. And some of you will have no interest, I guarantee you, because you're busy filling up your garage. And you have not come to the conclusion that when you make good things, ultimate things, that it's vanity. Because that's really what was going on with Solomon. And you'll have really no interest in this parable. But many of you perhaps have, do, will, and you continue to learn this life lesson as I do over and over again. Jesus said, he says this many, many times, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field which a man found and covered up. Then in his joy he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Done. See, short parable, right? And you're saying, good. Short parable. Kingdom of heaven, I mean, we could talk about that forever, but really it's a way of operation. It's a way of how I relate with you and you relate with me and how we relate with the king of the kingdom, right? The kingdom is the work, the rule, and the reign of God. That's the broad ideas, strokes of the kingdom. And the centerpiece is not a doctrine. More than that, it's a person who is the doctrine. It's the person of Christ. When Jesus said, I am amidst you, the kingdom has come in a person. So when we talk about kingdom, we're talking about truth. We're talking about ways of relating, yes, and valuing those things that the kingdom values and taking on the posture of the kingdom, absolutely. But we're also primarily talking about a person, the king of the kingdom. And the bold declaration of this parable, as many of the parables are, is this: the kingdom is the ultimate treasure. Said now with Solomon as the backdrop, might mean something. Do you believe this to be true? Do you believe this parable of Jesus? Is Jesus saying something profound in this parable to a needy world? What's he saying here? It's really simple. Parables often aren't hard to understand. They're just hard to align my life with. It's not rocket science. As someone on our teaching said the other day, and he'll be teaching in a couple weeks, Jesus wasn't a very good storyteller. I mean, his stories are so simple. His parables are simple. They are. They're not hard to understand. Most of them aren't hard to understand. This isn't hard to understand. It's maybe hard to embrace. Its worth eclipses the sum total. Notice in this parable, what does this man do? He sells. It's easy. He sells. And what does he sell? He sells his possessions. Stuff he's made, bought, and gathered. And how much did he sell? He sold it all. That's what the parable is about here. Simple, high-level stuff here. We don't know the details and all the specifics, but he sold everything that he had. Think of it. All that he has made, bought, and gathered is sold off. For what? Well, we look at this on multiple levels for a field. What was the field worth? We don't know. We just know it was worth everything that guy had. We have no idea. We also have no idea because the parable really isn't about the field. It's about the treasure that he found that's worth all he has. Now, does the seller know that there is a treasure in the field? Does the seller know? Read the parable. I don't think so. Because the buyer stumbled upon it. It was hidden. And then when he found it, he covered it back up again. Wonder why? So perhaps the seller thinks he's getting a great deal because he gets all that the buyer has. Yet the buyer realizes he's getting a great deal because there's something in the field, something more important than the field that he wants, something that eclipses all that he has. It's a treasure. Remember, the kingdom of heaven is like. And so as we read this parable, as we are the outsiders reading in, we see all these dynamics and we can see along with the buyer what the seller cannot, that he's getting ripped off, right? Wait till he finds out. The buyer sees what eclipses everything that he has, not the seller. So someone could pause and say, hold it, hold it. Is Jesus promoting ripping people off? That's misunderstanding the parable. Usually parables had one clear point. The buyer is, the treasure is being seen, that the buyer sees this treasure and it's such great worth that he sells everything he has. How much did he have? We don't know, but he sold everything that he had, and he was willing even to, oh, found the treasure, going to hide it because I don't want the seller to know that it's there. That's deception. Is that deception? Absolutely. But that's not Jesus' point. Jesus' point is he's showing the desperation, the eagerness of this guy. I want that treasure, so I'll sell everything and I'll even lie to the owner to get that field because I want that treasure. Pretty dramatic. Now imagine, if the buyer is, think about this. Imagine if the buyer is Solomon. Solomon. 2.1 trillion dollars. Would it be worth all he has? Is it only worth all you have if you don't have a lot? Would Jesus say to Solomon, if you sell all you have, 2.1 trillion, you've overpaid? But if someone with an average savings account sells all that he has, she has, then maybe that's a good deal. Is that what Jesus is getting at? Do you see the radical claim of this parable? The kingdom of heaven is like nothing in the garage eclipses God's kingdom. We can enjoy the toys. It's not saying that it's wrong to have things. That's not what this parable is about. We can enjoy, but all within the profound understanding of ultimate treasure. In fact, notice the next parable, verse 45. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls who, on like finding one pearl of great value, went and sold all that he had. And he bought it. As I look at all in the garage, as we look at all the stuff that we have in our garages, metaphorically speaking, I realize some of you live in apartments, so hopefully you get it. But anyways, do I really believe that the kingdom is of greater value? Do I really believe that? Would I make that purchase, sell all I have for the treasure? Am I so attached to what is in that garage that I would not sell? Do I find that sometimes those things in that garage actually do find... I find my worth, I find my sense of identity, I find my security in that, and an actual fact, that is actually my true ultimate treasure, what's in the garage. That stuff is really attached to my heart. Would I be able to sell all I have for the treasure? It's a hypothetical situation, but would I? Jesus is saying the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure where some guy finds it and he sells everything he has for that treasure. Another way to ask the question is, am I allowing wine to intoxicate me or wisdom to liberate me on this issue? Do I see eye to eye with Jesus on what is of true value? Notice the contrast in the stories. We have one guy in a story by the name of Solomon. He fills up his garage, he fills up his heart, but he loses. Notice this. Fills up his garage, loses. He even says he lost, vanity. Another guy in a story, the parable, he sells all that he has and he wins. Guy Solomon, he fills up his garage, and the emotion of that text, it's vanity. There's despair, there's darkness. Is that true? But the story of the parable, guy sells all he has and he does it with joy. In fact, other commentators say that perhaps the owner of the field was wealthy, and perhaps the purchaser of the field was poor. And you come to the end of the parable, and the poor man's rich and the rich man's poor. That's why this kingdom is called upside down. That's why a series is called Upside Down Kingdom. Upside down. The kingdom is the ultimate treasure. It eclipses the sum total of all we have accumulated in the garage. That's the radical claim of the gospel, isn't it? The radical claim of the gospel, which is centered on the person of the kingdom, is that this is ultimate treasure. It's not bad to own other kinds of things. It's not bad to even have a garage with stuff in it. But the ultimate treasure of life, of which a person can build their life ultimately, is the kingdom of God. That's a bold, brash, loud declaration. The kingdom is ultimate treasure. Notice as well in the parable, you've noticed this. Where's the treasure? Where's the treasure? Treasure's in a field. Back in that day, 2,000 years ago, people had to make arrangements to keep things safe. And so one method they employed was to bury their valuable possessions. If anyone did this before going off on a journey and failed to return, the possessions remained there and might be found later through a chance discovery, like in this parable. Or if there was a war, people would hide valuables to keep them from looting soldiers, and sometimes the owners would not survive, and nobody knew where the treasure was. And so notice where the treasure is in this story. It's in the field. So it's true that people hid treasures, but note the parable. The guy who owns the field has no idea what he is really selling. The seller, he has no idea. No idea. Because that's not the normal place you find treasure, is it? It's not. Where do you normally find treasure? Well, read Ecclesiastes. You find treasure in relationships, it's true. You find treasure perhaps in how big your bank account is or your estate is, that's true, type of treasure. You find treasure in your career or value, that's true. Those are the normal places you go to find treasure. But the treasure in the parable is perhaps in the last place you would expect it, a field reinforced by the fact that the seller has no idea what he's really selling to the buyer. It's a field. See, where is this field? We don't know. It's a parable, right? It's not Wrigley Field. It's never been referred to as the Field of Dreams. And it's not W.C. Fields, right? The American comedian, actor, juggler, writer. How many acres? We don't know. What was the terrain like? Any maple trees? I don't think so. Was it waterfront property? Could it be subdivided? But it is in that field that we know nothing about, that really has no beauty to it. There is a treasure. And the seller has no idea that in that ordinary field lies an extraordinary treasure of infinite worth. Remember we talked about kingdom, upside down kingdom? The kingdom is the ultimate treasure, but it's not found in the most obvious place. Do you see where this is going? True treasure is found in a field, kind of like a field. Remember the body that we find true treasure? Remember what Isaiah said about the body of Jesus? Who has believed what he has heard from us, Isaiah said? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form, speaking of Jesus, or majesty that we would look at him. Just a field. And no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief. And as one from whom hid their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Just a body. Not that attractive, according to Isaiah. A body birthed in a barn. Remember? A body birthed in a barn, grew up in Nazareth. Where's that? In a region called Galilee, backwards, backwoods, people that spoke funny, uneducated. That's what Galilee was known for. And it's in that field, in that body, there's a true treasure. Remember what John said? And the word became flesh. There's the field. And dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory as the only Son, from whom the Father, full of grace and truth. The treasure hangs on a cross. That's foolishness. The treasure preaches that the first will be last. The true treasure demonstrates that power is down, not up. And like the field, there was nothing about the body of Jesus that was out of the ordinary. In fact, like the field, you might not have even taken note. Just a body. Just a field. Like the owner of the field, it's perhaps the last place you would assume there to be treasure. For some, where we started looking for treasure and filling our garage was a little bit like Solomon, perhaps minus 2.1 trillion, of course, but we started maybe, and some of you, your story would be this. We looked in all the normal places that you would look for treasure. Stuff, careers, relationships, bank accounts. Not necessarily bad stuff, but that's where we looked for treasure. But then you found treasure in, where'd you find it? You found it in a field. Jesus. The exact opposite of what you were looking. In fact, if someone had come to you, say, 3 or 4 years ago, or 5 months ago, or 20 years ago, and said, you will find treasure in the field called Jesus, just that Jesus character, you would, and you will value his church, and you will build your life around his values, the kingdom, you would have laughed them out of the garage, wouldn't have you? Because you know where true treasure is. It's in my garage. But you all of a sudden are confronted with the last place you would have looked, as so many when Jesus did walk the face of the earth. He's just a field. There's nothing beautiful about him. He's not power like we thought power would be. But there's treasure there. God in a field. God in flesh. Upside down kingdom, to say the least, wouldn't you? The kingdom is the ultimate treasure. The invitation of the storyteller, the parable teller, is to come and build your life upon the ultimate treasure, to drink deeply, and to not go to those usual places culture may go to find true treasure, but to go to a field least expected and find ultimate treasure. And as I said, the challenge of the parable is fairly simple to understand. It might be hard to align your life with it, because that's not where you've normally gone to find ultimate treasure. I close with this. I changed my clothes yesterday. changed my clothes every day. Changed the closing of this message yesterday. I was watching on Instagram. Follow Instagram. A number of you on Instagram I follow. And I saw this great illustration, and I think I have the screenshot behind me. Some of you may have seen this. Some of you are thinking, who are those people? I get it, don't worry. But Paul McCartney, Carpool Karaoke. Some of you have seen this on The Late Late Show with James Corden. Let me just read what's here. Millions of viewers have watched it on YouTube. It's a huge hit, this one. You should YouTube it. And it's likely to eventually become one of the most popular installments in a staggeringly popular series which has featured everyone from Justin Bieber to Adele. So for those that don't see this, the guy on the left interviews different celebrities, Bieber, Adele, there's a celebrity, and here's McCartney. And it's very interesting. The writer says, pure joy, as one writer put it recently, few things on TV or the internet can generate as much pure joy as a solid Carpool Karaoke segment. Pure joy, indeed. The 23-minute segment is a breath of fresh air in a media landscape dominated by never-ending cycles of rage and rant. But there's something, now listen to what is said here, and it's just very short here, but there's something the writer says about the joy of this clip, which finds McCartney singing his old hits amid his old haunts in Liverpool. What is deeper than mere diversion? It's a joy that is intertwined with sadness, nostalgia, and the momentary transitioning realities of life, a joy that is satisfying because it is unsatisfying, a joy that sparks in us that ineffable sense that however beautiful the sunset, what we truly long for lies beyond the horizon. Long article, but let me read just one more sentence. And this is how art sparks joy, the writer says. It reminds us of life's impermanence and gestures at a connectedness between the past, present and future that we instinctively resonate with as creatures destined for eternity. We're destined for something that is so much bigger. Jesus speaks into these longings, these desires that often our music reflects. The kingdom, in one sense, lies beyond the horizon, but is now amongst us in Jesus. The music of the gospel for a people destined for eternity. Let's pray. The question, as we just quietly reflect on this morning, just to remind you, we're starting this series on the kingdom, upside down kingdom. We start with this parable with Solomon as the backdrop, that the kingdom is the ultimate treasure, the kingdom that is focused on a person. But it's in the most unexpected place, a field, Jesus, who in that broken, battered body was God in flesh, profound, true treasure. And much of our music and much of our narrative and our culture illustrates this longing to fill our hearts in this world that is really momentary, transitory. The question this morning I leave you with is, what bottle are you drinking out of? Wine? Embracing folly, just trying to fill and consume and get and gain, and or wisdom, true wisdom, that is ultimately personified in the person of Christ. Perhaps some of us this morning just need to say, God, thank you for all this stuff that I have. You might say literally, thank you, Lord, I have a garage and it is full of junk. You might say, thanks, Lord, for that. You've blessed us. You've blessed me. But you might pray something like, but God, help me to understand that this too will pass. This too will pass. And true wisdom says, build your life, root your life in true treasure. The kingdom of heaven is like treasure in a field. Some of you may just pray that prayer, God, help me to keep building true treasure. Some of you this morning might say, yeah, I've always thought that, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins. Uh-oh, maybe I'm not right. Maybe I need to heed the pathetic, sometimes pathetic story of Solomon. It's vanity. Maybe your prayer this morning is, Jesus, I come to you and declare the true beauty of Jesus, seen in the fact that this is God in flesh, dressed in a broken field to reach broken people with a life-changing message. Guide us in this series, guide us in these days, and as we enjoy this day on this Canada Day, we're grateful for all the great things you've given us, but help us never to lose touch with true treasure. Be our vision, be our hope, be our anchor. Let's stand as we respond in song.